to say how wrong I am. These are going to be harshly critical comments. They're actually not meant to be fair. They're meant to be a little bit of a wake-up call. The scale that I think some people in Taiwan operate on is not the same scale that I operate on. And I want to draw a contrast between those two things. And I think give some information that you will may find incomplete, but nonetheless relevant. The title of this panel is Taiwan's Economic Strategy and Regional Trends. I have to say I don't pay much attention to purely domestic Taiwanese action. In terms of international economic strategy, I don't see one. So I could just stop and say there is no Taiwan strategy with regard to regional trends and move on. I'll give you a little more than that. I'm going to talk about the regional and international economic environment as it bears on Taiwan, and then what I think Taiwan's strategy should be, which you, of course, may not agree with, but you will be able to see that what I think it should be, it has just no connection to what it actually is. So let's talk about the regional and economic environment. If you follow my writings on China, you know I consider China to be an aging, indebted, slow growth, soon to be stagnant economy. We've had other economies in this path before. It's not a surprise. When you are aging and when you have a lot and when you've wasted a ton of money, you're not going to grow a lot. You could either say they're going to grow slowly or they're going to not grow. Some people think there's going to be a crisis. I don't. But in any of those cases, Taiwan is not going to be able to live off China because China is growing quickly. It would only be able to live off privileged market access granted by the Chinese. I don't find that to be a very palatable option. Some people apparently do, but I don't. Another area of the world relevant to Taiwan is what I think I'm the first person who said it is not creative at all. The VIP countries, Vietnam, Indonesia, Philippines, why would we group those countries? Because they have young labor forces and a combined population 20 times that of Taiwan, 450 some million people. So I don't, there's the idea that Taiwan should, I should set this up. They're going to outgrow China. They're going to either outgrow China by a lot if they adopt the right policies, or not so much, but they're going to outgrow China in any case. They are younger, less indebted economies. That's what happens. Taiwan spends a lot of time trying to deal with ASEAN and talking about political recognition. I don't see any economic gain to that. Vietnam, Indonesia, the Philippines, none of these countries want to be dependent on the Chinese capital or the Chinese market. They therefore would love a supplementary partner in Taiwan, other partners as well, but certainly in Taiwan. They're going to want to export to Taiwan as well, so there has to be mutual openness. But if these countries are approached on a purely economic basis without seeking a political dimension, they're going to be increasingly interested, and they're going to be increasingly good partners because they are going to grow quickly, even with mediocre policies. India, I've talked about to Taiwanese audiences for a while, it's basically the VIP countries plus another 750 million people. They have very high need for capital. They really don't want to depend on Chinese capital. They don't want to have the same kind of trade relationship that they have with China now. They would rather have a different relationship with China or with other countries. What are your chances to get good national level economic policies out of India? They're not that great. But Indian states have some discretion over policy, and there are 10 Indian states with a population greater than 50 million people. You don't have to deal with Delhi. You can find three Indian states and have a nice $150 million person market there. And finally, the United States. The U.S. has played this role for decades of providing growth to the rest of the world through market access. That's what the U.S. balance of payments deficit is. It provides GDP growth to everyone else. You are all aware where we are, that role is being threatened. It's not just Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders is a protectionist. Bernie Sanders came out of nowhere to be a viable challenger to Hillary Clinton, and she's still blaming him for ruining her presidential chances. I don't think populism is going to go away when President Trump leaves the scene, whenever that may be. So the U.S. is likely to be a more selective partner. We're going to see, friends of the United States who we can run trade deficits with, and rivals of the United States we don't want to run trade deficits with. That's a very simple-minded statement, but I only have 10 minutes because Rupert's a dictator. The question there is, will Taiwan qualify in the good category of future American partners. And certainly there are a lot of reasons for Taiwan to qualify, but ensuring Taiwan qualifies and improving Taiwan's orientation towards the whole rest of the world is my second section. The biggest gap between outside observers, and I'm definitely one, and the Taiwanese decision makers that I talk to is there's just an implicit belief that everyone understands that Taiwan matters in some way. And economically, Taiwan doesn't matter. That is not said as an insult. It's said as an encouragement to action. Understand the nature of the economic choice. The U.S. isn't going to come to Taiwan's rescue because Taiwan doesn't matter enough to the U.S. It matters some, but not in an environment of increasing U.S. Populism. China could bail out Taiwan with that privileged market access I mentioned before, but there'd be huge political strains. So the answer is Taiwan needs to save itself. Saving itself is not, yearning for diplomatic recognition. Saving itself is taking unilateral economic action that make Taiwan a better partner. So my bar, that what I'm trying to tell you is that Taiwan needs to be extremely aggressive economically, not responsive, not hoping for the TPP, not hoping for something to happen that's out of Taiwan's control or blaming the Chinese for preventing it to happen. Consider what the last two Taiwanese governments have promised and done against that standard, and you get a sense of why I don't believe there to be a real Taiwanese economic strategy. And Taiwan can make itself very appealing. Taiwan can be a very appealing partner that on economic grounds, all the countries I've mentioned, the VIP countries, the Chinese to some extent, although politics will always win there, the United States, the Indians, will want, holding everything else constant, that's out of Taiwan's control, to engage more with Taiwan, to sign more formalized agreements, to enhance, facilitate trade and investment. What are some things to do along those lines? And every time I say this, I feel like I should just stop now. Because I cannot say anything that I'm not going to be told, well, we can't do that, that's a political landmine. For those of you who are old enough, we've heard countries do this before. When countries say you can't engage in deep structural reform because it's politically too difficult, what follows them is them dropping down the global income rankings. Taiwan's not that high to begin with. Do you want to always be looking up at 3% GDP growth for the rest of all of our lives? Do you want to always never get into the top 30 in global income? That's what's going to happen. Taiwan doesn't have resources. It doesn't have a big labor force. It needs to have extremely good policy. So extremely good policy, much more competitive domestic market. Low taxes, of course, but also bad firms have to fail. You're a lousy firm, you die. And that way the government's not getting as much money in tax revenue. It's also not wasting as much money propping up firms that are just reducing the productivity of the economy, making it less efficient, and then making politicians more scared to engage in open trade. I'll say that again. If you keep bad firms in business, you're more scared of competitive trade, which is the way I read Taiwanese politics for a long period of time. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Foreign firms in Taiwan should get more rights to compete. Not subsidies, not sweetheart deals, just fair competition. Now, of course, there are some foreign firms who really want the subsidies. I actually think Taiwan should stop talking about fair trade and investment agreements with those high reward partners. I think it should start thinking about signing unfair trade and investment agreements. It should make concessions to countries that are going to grow quickly, because Taiwan's not going to grow quickly without making those concessions. Don't try to wrangle every last point out of the Vietnamese or the Indonesians. First of all, you try to do that with the Indonesians, you're never going to come up with any sort of agreement anyway. But for Taiwan, the agreement can see 55% of the benefits going to Indonesia, because if Indonesia gets its act together, it's 240 million people and 7% GDP growth for 25 years. And I think you want to be part of that process. And that's also with Indian states. I don't mean to just pick on Indonesia. So I started off harshly. I will be done within 1 minute. I started off harshly. So that's one good thing about this presentation. I started off harshly, but I hope it's clear. The reason is I see Taiwan as leaving the period of growing fast because China's going to grow fast. I think that's obvious. When I first started saying it, it didn't seem to be obvious, but if you don't think it's obvious, we can fight about that in Q&A. If that's true, you need a much more radical Taiwanese economic strategy than I've seen proposed. It needs to set aside the idea that that Taiwan needs to seek political recognition or sign only balanced trade agreements. That's not what should be done. And we can talk about the details in more depth, but I wanted to make clear the point that there's a reason, the reason I don't see that there's an international Taiwanese international economic strategy is that it's completely inadequate as compared to what I think will actually serve Taiwan, make Taiwan a rich and rapidly growing country going forward.
Thanks, Derek. Bob.
Okay, thanks.
No tomatoes, that's a good sign.
Yeah. I hate to say this, but I actually agree with most of his points. But I disagree on a number of points as well. But the first point I would say I disagree would be, I think Taiwan does have an economic strategy, an internal one, which you in some ways touched on, I think. As all of you know from Taiwan, the 5+2, I'm not sure all five are viable industries, the Innovative Industries Initiative, but I do think that it reflects a strategy that recognizes that China, Korea, others, China in particular, is gradually replacing or displacing what used to be the comparative advantage of Taiwan in terms of IT and technology, et cetera. It's gradually being displaced. So it needs to move up the value chain, the global value chain. Now, exactly whether all five will work or not work, I don't know. You do really have to get into it. But I think it's a basic recognition that this is the critical problem Taiwan faces. And I think they did have they did produce a good program for all five of these. I've been a little bit more familiar with Taoyuan one, smart machinery, with Silicon Valley, or Taichung with smart machinery. So I think some are actually viable, but the most important point here is that there's a recognition that Taiwan is at a critical stage. It cannot stay where it is in the past. And so I think it has the strategy, and then I agree with Derek in saying that, therefore, structural reform is really critical. From all of the things that I've read about Taiwan's economic policies, especially in terms of foreign investment, what I've read essentially is that Taiwan still has a very fairly restrictive and cumbersome and a sort of set of regulations and structures for foreign investors coming into Taiwan, in particular for innovative industries, not just for the state-owned ones, like telecommunication, oil, gas, et cetera, not just for those. But I read the AmCham white paper all the time, the reports. I read the AIT report on the investment environment, the State Department report. And clearly, I think what Derek is saying is right, and that is the most important thing Taiwan can do in the long term is really think hard about how you actually attract foreign investors, innovators, entrepreneurs into all of these different innovative areas that Taiwan needs. And so I think that's key. And you won't see the action or results quickly. It will be quite a number of years. And maybe people won't be paying attention to it. But this is the critical part for Taiwan's survival as basically as an economy and as a country in that sense. So I think hopefully they will recognize this. And by the way, there was a sports theme earlier today, and I think of this U.S. Open Tennis Championship where Taiwan won the women's double with Zhang Yongran and Martina Hingis. So my point is, you've got to have Taiwan. Taiwan has a lot of talent, domestic talent, but you need to put it together with foreign entrepreneurs, foreign innovators, put it together, and then you can win the U.S. Open. Or whatever comes up next. But I really do think this is a critical question and critical element for Taiwan going into the future. Now, on the new southbound policy, which I think is more external, here again, I agree with Derek. I think that's where the future should be in many ways for Taiwan, because the first thing you know right away is that when you look at Taiwan's trade and investment figures, 40% export to one market, whether it's China or whatever else, is not the right policy. Too much put on one horse. Not calling anybody a horse, but, but you know, it's too much put into that one thing. So you really have to basically diversify. And of course, politically, it's also important. But I think even economically, it's an important policy to diversify. And if you look at the southbound policy targets, they're all, as Derek said, fast growing now. India, 7%, 8% growth a year. And then you look at the Philippines, Vietnam, and so on, 6 to 7%, basically on par with China in terms of growth rate. And then you look at Thailand and others, Malaysia, 4 to 5%. And this has been maintained for some years now. So I think if you look to the future, and again, as Derek said, these are also low-cost manufacturing places. There are also potential markets. And so in many, many different ways, I think this is the right policy in the right timing. I forget who mentioned this earlier today. I think it might have been Walter Lohman. In terms of timing of this new southbound policy, I think it is the right policy. The question is, how do you carry it out? And you know, and I think when I was in Taiwan just a couple weeks ago talking to James Huang, who's now the chairman of TITRA, and with John Deng and others, they recognize a lot of problems. In fact, James Huang said that he looked at the statistics, and like there are hundreds of thousands of Taiwanese companies all over, in China, on mainland China and Southeast Asia and so on, but there are only 90 in India. And so why? Well, because they don't like the food. Anyway. What I'm saying is it's a cultural thing. So the strategy is then you need to have some big company go there, make an investment.
Restaurant company going there first.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm getting to that.
Okay.
So you have Foxconn, you have whatever big company with a lot of people investing there. Then the restaurants will come. And other things will come, the subcontractors. So it seems like a joke, but it really is a cultural barrier in terms of language, in terms of other kinds of things. But I think India is a big market, and I think Southeast Asia is a growing market. And I think this is where you should be looking at in terms of encouraging, like we do, in, for example, in the U.S. government, we have the commercial service who help with intel, information, encouragement for companies going, private sector companies, going to these countries to facilitate their investment and trade. So I think this is a strategy, and I think this is a very good strategy, and they just have to really implement it. Again, and a third point I'd make is that, again, I agree with Derek here, and I've been saying this for some time. I think Taiwan should, especially at this particular time, should move off of that TPP, RCEP, FTA kick. Okay, it's not the right timing in any case. Maybe in later on. At this point, if you look at what President Trump and the Trump administration is doing, questioning NAFTA, questioning CORUS, questioning everything else, for Taiwan to keep on focusing on some symbolic thing about signing something is really wasting a lot of energy. So there's a question about why didn't, I think somebody asked, I think it was Walter who asked about the TPP or the FTA. Why not an FTA? I think it's a waste of time. First of all, if you do try one, it's going to be really hard. The conditions are going to be so tough that you don't really want it to begin with. So I think get off of that, work on the purely sort of very transactional, real investments like Foxconn's doing. And Foxconn got a lot of tax incentives, as all of you know. And isn't that an FTA? When you get a lot of incentives from the taxes and whatever else, that's preferential sort of treatment in some ways. So you can get a lot of those advantages without really having to negotiate for years on an FTA or even a BIA. But if you could, that's fine, if it's open. But I think I would focus on actual economic grassroots investments, trade, both into Taiwan and out of Taiwan into the U.S. So I would say that as a conclusion, because I think she's about to lift something up.
Hey. Yeah.
But I think in conclusion, I would say for in terms of U.S.-Taiwan relations, this actually is a great opportunity for upgrading, as the title says, U.S.-Taiwan relations. Because U.S. has a lot of the innovative industries in Silicon Valley, elsewhere. So Taiwan should make a real effort, companies in particular, to link up, look for, scour the landscape for innovative U.S. companies, startups, venture capitals that are interested in developing these innovative industries that Taiwan would also want to do. So you need a lot of effort both going in and out. The one thing I would disagree with Derek, because I've been agreeing with him too much, is that I do think that Taiwan can come up with special policies in terms of, I know China has their Shanghai FTZ, others have done a few things, but I think Taiwan can come up with some policies that can attract U.S. investors in particular in these areas by tax incentives, privileges, holidays, like a Hsinchu Science Park type thing. So we need a new one in the coming years so Taiwan can start developing this, attracting it, and upgrading U.S.-Taiwan relations as well.
Thank you, Bob. The new premier must have been listening to you, because one of the initiatives he immediately announced was more money for sports in Taiwan. So I suspect that you and he are nicely in
same
line.
Same page.
Indeed. Chiyoko, please.
All right. First of all, thank you and congratulations to GTI. This has been a fascinating conversation, an amazing conference. And thank you also, too, for being here for the very last panel. But I think it's the most important because we've really highlighted, even in the political and security panels, about the importance of economic strength, because a country is only as strong, a country is only as secure as its economic foundation and also the education of its population. I don't want to be a conformist, but I actually do agree with Derek and Bob about placing too much emphasis on trade, trying to conclude trade agreements. When I was invited to talk on this panel about economic issues, my first instinct was to talk about the prospects for TPP-11 and how Taiwan may or may not be able to negotiate its way into a expanded TPP-11 down the line. One, that's a very hypothetical issue. And two, I realized really it's not an economic issue. It's much more of a political one. And when we look more broadly at the Asia-Pacific region, there are really two major risks in the region that is really damaging the growth trajectory of the region at large, including Taiwan. And the first is the possibility of a spillover effect of political risk. And right now, there is a decoupling of the political and security anxieties in the region. We talked about North Korea. We are also aware about the rapid militarization of China. There's also tremendous unresolved sources of friction from territorial disputes in the East China Sea as well as the South China Sea. There's rising nationalism and politicization of historical memory. These are all leading to incredible tensions that would upset the balance of power. This right now is not having a direct impact on the economy, but as we have seen over the last, even the past few weeks or days, the North Korea situation, we're already seeing some repatriation of assets back into Japan and South Korea in particular. But if this continues, there could be this convergence of the political and economic risks that Taiwan would not be isolated from either. The second risk is the ability of the Asia-Pacific region, including Taiwan, to meet the competitive needs of the 21st century. And if there is a value system that unites the region, it is this faith in continued economic growth and expectations for the East Asian miracle in particular to continue. And right now, unlike in the United States or in Europe, globalization is not a dirty word in Taiwan. It is not a dirty word in other parts of Asia either. Being part of the global economy, setting rules for trade that meet the needs of the rapid transaction of goods and services is seen as a good thing and a way forward for Taiwan as well as others. But what we do need to remember is that the formulas that have led to growth in the past won't necessarily work in the future, and that export-led growth of goods in particular are facing much more scrutiny, especially from the United States under a Trump administration, which is very much focused on the trade deficits, especially on a bilateral level. And so what Taiwan really needs to do is to stay ahead of the economic curve And there are elements of the so-called East Asian miracle. That this is a publication by the World Bank in 1991 that touted that the Asian tigers, including Taiwan as well as Japan and Korea and Singapore and a number of other countries, they were able to succeed. They have been able to succeed because of a strong social safety net, ensuring equitable distribution of wealth, investing in public education, investing in public infrastructure, strategic government spending on key sectors that would define national interests. These still remained pertinent today. But what no longer holds is this expectation for a continued surge in export-led growth of manufactured goods. And instead, what governments, including Taipei, need to really focus on is furthering the exports. If we're looking at the export sector, it's not looking so much at the export of goods, but rather than services. And that requires innovation and flexibility, which is really part of what we call the fourth industrial revolution, which is led primarily by the development of artificial intelligence and technological connectivity. But there is also, it's a revolution. There is a downside to any revolution, and there are losers as well as winners. And how do you win this fourth industrial revolution is going to be the key focus of any successful government economic policy. And so the World Economic Forum outlined a number of attributes for success in the 21st century. And they talk about proactive adaptation by corporations and governments and about what do they need? They need critical thinking. They need ability to be creative, have emotional intelligence, have flexibility, and have good people management skills. Now, the challenge for Asian governments and the challenge for Taipei in particular is to succeed in the 21st century will be to nurture these much-needed skills. This actually can play to Taiwan's advantage. We've already talked about Taiwan being resource poor, but it is people rich. It just needs to be able to have policies that will invest in its most important asset, which is brain power, essentially. So I also want to point out that much of what traditional Taipei thinking has focused on is focused so much on issues that are out of its control. It depends on external factors, including political pressures, its position in the international community. In particular, we've talked about the limitations that it faces in reaching multilateral trade agreements and bilateral trade deals as well. But I find that there are really three elements of resilience for Taiwan to, as Derek said, save itself, or maybe paraphrasing or riffing off President Trump is to say, keep Taiwan great. So those three elements that give Taiwan a competitive edge in East Asia against Japan, against South Korea, or even against mainland China, and it would certainly make it more attractive to its supporters and potential allies, especially in Southeast Asia. So what are they? The first one is to cultivate entrepreneurship. And according to the Global Entrepreneurship and Development Institute, Taiwan continues to be the top-ranking Asian country for starting a business in the region. It actually came in at 16th place this year. That doesn't seem that amazing. But compared to Japan, which came in at 25th place, South Korea at 27, and the mainland at 48th, it's doing very, very well. And the Institute actually gave Taiwan full marks for providing access to risk finance in the financial sector, and especially access in the equities market. And it also gave very high marks to Taiwan for its potential to generate new products. It also, it should be fairly obvious, gave it very high marks for a highly educated workforce and its ability also to apply and create new technologies. The second source of resilience is its ability to embrace plurality and diversity. I only have 1 minute? Okay. So it's an ability to actually look from outside, look to outside talent, not simply look within its own borders, but to be able to tap into foreign talent, also to bring back Taiwanese diaspora back into Taiwan, to absorb them into leadership positions or into cabinet positions in the government as well. We all know about the Taiwanese cabinet having more PhDs than the American counterpart. The third source of resilience and indeed envy is Taiwan has really set the gold standard in Asia for in gender equality. Taiwan, of course, is not perfect, but with the constitutional court ruling in favor of same-sex marriage and LGBT rights, it's actually, regardless of what actually happens down the line, it has highlighted the fact that it sees this issue as something that is fundamental to the value system and the democratic ideals of Taiwan. This is far ahead of almost all other Asian countries, and it really is that very good example of Taiwan as a living, thriving democracy. And of course, the fact that Tsai Ing-wen is not only the first Taiwanese female leader, but she is one of the very, very few leaders in Asia who is a woman who won leadership in her own right, not because she's the wife of someone, it's the daughter of someone. That has been very inspirational to women, not just in Taiwan and in Asia, but in the world. So in conclusion, for Taiwan to remain competitive, of course, it should continue to pursue trade agreements and efforts to carve and preserve its space in the international field. But at the same time, it should really focus on the cultivating and nurturing skills that will keep it competitive in the years to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Shioka. If we have some time, I'd like to come back to the issue of demographics too, in respect to GDP growth and what's going on with Taiwan's people growth. Peter, over to you.
Me?
Time for you.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here, and particular with the distinguished panelists of this program. I'm a little bit more optimistic than anyone else on the Taiwan-US economic partnership. And for various reasons, because of my decades of research on the East Asia trade and development. All right, Taiwan is the 10th largest trading partner for the United States. And particularly, it's a natural trading partner from my research for the United States, and which I'll show you the figures. Number two, Taiwan has been playing a very important role in the US global supply chain, and I show you the diagram, all right, which contribute to the US economy. The contribution of the US, Taiwan's contribution to the US global supply chain is greater than the total of from those from Indonesia, Philippines, and Thailand combined. I show you a diagram in just a minute. Taiwan's export contributed to 208,000 jobs for the American people. This is according to the USTR. But the think tank in Taiwan estimate is more than 350,000 jobs. All right? So I will just present what are the policy implications from my research. All right, first of all, we all know that the trade deficit in any country is because of the macroeconomic imbalance between domestic saving and the investment. Taiwan has an excess saving of about 14.4% of its total GDP with only moderate budget deficit. On the contrary, U.S. has under-saving and also has a sizable trade deficit. This is a fundamental issue of the U.S. trade deficit. All right, by the end of 2017, Taiwan has excess saving about $325 billion. All right, that is, you know, the deposit and the lending gap in Taiwan is something like a 73%. So Taiwan is a lot of money. All right, now the question is, Taiwan could what? Make a good use to dispose those excess savings, which would be mutually beneficial to both countries. Then I will also say Taiwan offer a greater, much, much greater of the intellectual property right protection than any other country. Why? So I advocate that the US firm who invests in Taiwan can maximize the value of his IPR without any compromise, all right? U.S. investment in Taiwan is unlike U.S. investment in a big country with a big market. Why? Because if you do that, you will only have a short-term profit at the expense of losing the long-term. All right. Next one, I want to say that what? With those excess savings, Taiwan should play a much more aggressive role, Northern defensive law in terms of his outward foreign direct investment. Foxconn is one example. I give you some more, all right? Now, somebody this morning and the previous asked, what can Taiwan help the United States to cut his trade deficit? The answer is here. U.S. has a trade deficit with ASEAN countries, which account about 11.1% of the total U.S. trade deficit. How can the U.S. cut the trade deficit? U.S. can cut the trade deficit with ASEAN countries by making investment in Taiwan. And I show you what the industry that the U.S. will be benefit by investing in Taiwan and cut the U.S. trade deficit. All right, I show you the diagram on page 16, if I have time. So therefore, further cooperation between the two countries, particularly the bilateral economic partnership, should be pursued.
Is he going to get that extra?
All right.
No, he's not.
On the second one is I should advocate the service trade. Everybody talk about U.S. trade deficit. Do you realize the United States has a trade surplus on the service trade as much as $240 billion on average in the past 5 years? All right? And how can U.S. you know, expand the service trade? The three conditions which made by my fellow economists at the Brookings says that the three conditions will determine the market potential for the U.S. service trade. Number one, trade openness. Number two, democracy. And number three, access to major financial center in Asia. Taiwan fulfill all three conditions. Why the U.S. don't take this opportunity? All right? And of course, for Taiwan's own sake, Taiwan need to liberalize its trade. I agree with my panelists that the Taiwan need to deregulate its service trade for his own sake. All right? So United States should liberalize also his technological trade, particularly in the high-tech sector. Liberalization of the trade, not the protection, is a win-win game for both. All right? Number three, any trade deal, all right, is required the two levels of the political game, both domestic and international. So my advice is that the U.S. should credit to Taiwan for his role model in the IPR protection. I do not advocate that the United States apply the Section 301, that is stick, all right, to make America great again. I advocate that United States should apply both carrot and the stick policy, all right, to distinguish the reliable ally and the unmanageable rival. And you know who is it? This morning until now, you know Taiwan is a reliable ally. Mm-hmm. And all of you know who is the unmanageable rival, right? Mm-hmm. I don't have to say that. So, yeah. So what? The U.S. only applied the Section 301. I said I did advocate for that. But what I want to advocate is that U.S. should award Taiwan with his accommodation to the U.S. demand for the IPR, right? Because Taiwan has done much, much more to protect the U.S. IPR than any other country in the world, all right? And so to apply both carrot and the stick in the U.S. trade policy, the President Trump's administration recognized it by granting an economic partnership agreement. Many of you talk about FTA. I understand that the President Trump has no test on that terminology. So I changed the terminology from FTA to Economic Partnership Agreement. This paper was published in January 2017. And the fact that Japan and the European Union signed the EPA proved what I said was correct. All right, now, Taiwan has to accommodate. My recommendation is to accommodate the U.S. aspiration to increase more of its agricultural commodity.
Can you wrap up after this slide? We've just got a little bit of time left.
Okay, all right. So I put quickly. So therefore, the question is that political will is the key to any trade deal. All right, now, I should advocate that we should focus on the big sales ticket rather than on the controversial sector-specific issue. If I were the CEO of Messi or Bloomingdale, what I'm going to concern is the total sales of my merchandise, rather than to insist that my customer to buy 10 pairs of shoes in a day. What would happen if my customer say, Mr. Chow, I don't want to buy shoes. I buy 10 in a set of the higher value of the LV purse or packet. All right, so I don't have time to show that, but I prove that this is the data from OECD and WTO. Taiwan's contribution to the U.S. global supply chain is greater than the total of the three countries. All right, this is a sector that Taiwan can invest in the U.S., that the U.S. compare the advantage. Let me allow one more, all right? This is a diagram I show. I classify all the U.S. and Taiwan's trade sector into the four group. I measure U.S. comparative advantage vertically. Taiwan's comparative advantage horizontally. This is the area that the U.S. Oh, by the way, if the index is greater than one, the U.S. has a comparative advantage in one and three. But U.S. has a disadvantage in those two. On Taiwan, I measure it horizontally. On the right of Taiwan, those two are the Taiwan has a strong comparative advantage. And so therefore, this is the area. Each dot represents an industry. And that is multi-billions. Each dot represents a multi-billion business for American people. This is the area that Taiwan has a strong comparative advantage. And the U.S. has a strong comparative disadvantage and in ASEAN country. So United States can cut its trade deficit by investing in lots of sector in Taiwan and to cut its trade deficit to create more jobs for American people.
Thank you, Peter, very much indeed. We're grateful for your time.
Okay, all right. So I think I have to finish, but let me allow, okay. The focus there, okay. All right. Let me get a conclusion, all right?
Please, Peter, thank you.
All right, if we have a very, very good comprehensive economic partnership agreement, the U.S. trade deficit, which only counts about 1.8%, will be further cut. U.S. GDP will increase, which will create more jobs, and therefore, I advocate that the U.S. and Taiwan are on the same boat. A strategic partnership between those two countries is mutually beneficial for both countries. So both sides should be more serious about the bilateral U.S.-Taiwan Economic Partnership Agreement. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before I, we've got about 15 minutes. I'm just going to just drive at one. Let's make a quick observation, which would appear to be parochial, but it's one that I've noted over many years in working on Taiwan-related matters. Then I'll ask our panelists a quick question on investment. There is no doubt, Chioko, that you make this great point about the contrasted PhDs with Taiwan's cabinet. But it's always struck me that one thing that Taiwan has struggled with, specifically since the last Lee Teng-hui administration at the end of the 90s, is persuading business people to serve at the highest levels of the Taiwan government. And what invariably we've come up with is a very academic-heavy leadership on Taiwan's economic direction. And sometimes a disconnect between the needs of business and investment and how the government operates and the sorts of strategies that get rolled out. They can be overly academic and as a consequence, there can be a challenge in translating that into a practical strategy that can be employed and that is successful. I wanted to ask each of you, I just want to come back to this issue of investment for a second because it's critical. You know, there hasn't been a major private equity investment in Taiwan in over a decade now. The Carlyle Group is trying to get its money out from the last one that it's made. It's had three attempts, and it's still unsuccessful. Could you, each of you, I'd be very interested, just very briefly, please, just give your thoughts on just quickly, on the issue of investment. How does Taiwan improve inbound investment into the island? How does it make itself a more attractive place for capital? And you can go at this any way you like, but just offer something that perhaps we wouldn't read in the FT or the Journal or some other publication.
Well, you gave step one, which is reassure investors they can get their money out when they want to.
Yeah.
Why am I going to put my money into any venture if I can't be sure I can get it out?
Yeah.
So the long-standing dispute over how easy it is to get capital out of Taiwan has been resolved by foreign business. And the Taiwanese government can say anything it wants, but foreign business has decided that they don't trust the Taiwanese government to let their money leave. And the second one, and I'm only going to say two, is there a bunch of, and I hate to drive home this point, and I deliberately don't mention specific strategies because there's always somebody who gets upset when I do, there are a bunch of lousy firms in Taiwan that would really benefit from being taken over by better firms.
Yeah.
But they're not available for sale. I don't know what firms I could be talking about. I mean, it's a mystery. But you have a huge market where firms could take them over, make money for themselves, improve performance for the Taiwanese economy. That is an actual win-win for everybody from a small group of special interests. And if they think they can get their money out, you would see a surge in private investment in Taiwan. Now, those are two difficult tasks, but they're very simple.
Yeah. Thanks, Derek. Bob?
Yeah, I think it's too complicated to be able to discuss within 1 minute. Here. But I would say there are examples around the world where you could actually, in the region, where you could actually see that. I mean, Singapore's policies, send people there, figure out how it does open up in terms of various industries, whether it's finance or whether it's private equity or whether it's fintech now more and more. There are a lot of examples out there. Hong Kong is, to some extent in the past, an example of that. So I think if Taiwan were serious about doing something really fairly, I think, significant. I think it has a lot of lessons to learn from different economies already there. And so I think, but I do agree with on one point, which is politically it may be more difficult. Mm-hmm. I think Singapore had Lee Kuan Yew and others and a fairly strong sort of political system. They didn't have to worry so much about it, and they didn't have many resources either. So they had no real choice. They had to open up. But I think the political situation is a little bit different. But I think Taiwan should be able to adapt from learning from Singapore and others, the models there. And you know, and I think there are a lot of bright people in Taiwan who can go out there and learn the lessons.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob. Mm-hmm. Chioko, do you have some thoughts?
Yeah, so attracting FDI obviously is a challenge, but I think equally is an equally important challenge is to ensure that there is no capital flight, and especially brain drain. The flight of human capital.
Yeah.
And if there are policies that could ensure that the best and brightest of Taiwan stay, and there is capital from foreign investors that would encourage them to stay as well, that kind of win-win partnership would be something that the government could look into as well.
Thank you. Peter, do you have a couple of thoughts?
Just 2 points. Okay. Well, number one is that the U.S. investment in Asia country would be much, much better off if the U.S. company has some partnership with Taiwan because of Taiwan's geographic advantage to provide the follow-up service. Number two is the Imperial Survey. For those Japanese companies who are more successful doing business in Taiwan, are those Japanese firms which have strategic partnership with Taiwan. Okay, let me make clear. For those Japanese firms who make more profit in China are mostly those Japanese firms who have had strategic partnership with a Taiwanese firm because of language and other factors.
Thank you, Peter. I'd like to invite anybody to have a question. Yes, sir, just in the back to the right here, please. Yes?
Two of them.
Which one?
Hey, thank you for a presenter. I'm a MS student and John
Hopkins.
I'm sorry,
just very quickly, sort of rules of engagement. I wasn't here earlier, but name, affiliation, and then get to your question super quick.
Okay, my name is Bo. I'm from Johns Hopkins Insights. I'm from Taiwan. I just want to ask, like, a lot of you like mentioned like Taiwan should not focus on TPP or other FTA anymore, but my question is focused on US is like, after withdrawal from TPP, like many Asian countries feel like US is not here anymore economically, and many countries turning their eyes to China to depend on their, to see how they will dominate regional liberalism. So I want to ask, what is US strategy to stay in Asia Pacific, to continue to dominate the economy order in Asia Pacific after withdrawal of the TPP? Thank you.
Do you guys all understand the question?
What's the U.S. strategy to engage Asia economically after TPP? Fair representation? I say as somebody who works sometimes with the Trump administration, who doesn't hate the Trump administration, I don't know what the strategy is. I don't think we have a strategy yet. We don't have a fleshed out government yet. We're missing key players who would engage with Asia in a number of government departments. I think if I were to be optimistic, I think there is the possibility of bilateral engagement with a number of U.S. friends in Asia. I wish it had started already. I am trying to get one engagement started. It is not with Taiwan. sorry about that. What's the U.S. strategy? The U.S. doesn't have a strategy. The number one U.S. strategy with regard to economic engagement with Asia was the president saying TPP is terrible and I'm leaving and fulfilling a campaign promise. What's replaced it? Concern about North Korea. That's the main U.S. engagement with Asia, which is not economic. Where are we going? I think we are going eventually towards bilateral-based economic engagement, which is going to be tailored to different countries, not always FTAs, not a grand grouping. I think that can be effective when we get there. So I don't think I'm not hopeless for the U.S. in the future, but if you're asking me what the U.S. is doing now as somebody who's sort of involved, we're not doing anything coherent that I can tell.
Anybody else have
just
anything
a quick comment, I think, more general comment. I think the reason I guess I'm not underscoring the importance of TPP and free trade agreements and so on and so forth as much is that I think a lot of things, like Peter was saying, all the statistics here about U.S.-Taiwan relations, all that was done without any FTA, BIA, TPP. The world continues to grow. A lot of the Southeast Asian countries that grew without any of these agreements. And so to put too much into it to say that you have to have an agreement to be able to grow your relationship, I think is wrong. I mean, China has grown so fast without any agreement with the United States because it simply did things. And so I think that's my general point. I think the U.S. can, private sector, has a lot of investment in Southeast Asia. It can continue to lead in terms of economic ties with cooperation with other countries, including China, but Japan, Taiwan. So all of that, I think, can be done without putting too much sort of symbolic weight on some agreement. By now, for one thing, within APEC, for example, where I worked a little bit, tariff now is down to 5%, average tariff. I mean, how much more do you want to go down to get advantage in terms of trade? So I think a lot of it is maybe our fault because I was with the government and we were trying to get TPP passed. So we put a lot of weight on the symbolic, strategic nature of this thing. It's U.S. presence, it's a pivot, it's this and that. But business is business. And I think it's a little bit exaggerated.
And I think one of the weaknesses of the TPP was that there wasn't as strong an economic argument for it for U.S. businesses. And so that even after 10 years of implementation, it would only increase U.S. GDP by 1 percentage point or thereabouts, which isn't really, I mean, it's not nothing, but it's not something that everyone's going to say, oh, we're going to miss opportunities unless we sign on to this. So hence, there was a lot of argument about the strategic nature of it, the diplomatic argument, the broader Pax Americana argument about it, which I believe in. But it's not something that corporate America is going to lose out on if it's not part of. But I do want to point out that TPP 11, the prospect of continuing TPP without the United States is still alive and kicking. Whether or not it goes on with the 11 remaining countries, or it could be a different parameter of the Japan, New Zealand and Australia, and Singapore, it could be a number of combinations. But it is continuing. And one of the chapters in TPP, chapter 30, I believe, about the final provisions, it goes on to say that members of APEC member countries, which would include Taiwan, have the opportunity to join. So it's not dead. There's hope, too, that by keeping TPP 11 alive, that when there is a new administration, because believe it or not, the Trump administration will not last forever, there is opportunity for the United States to reconsider its decision again.
Okay, just quickly, I agree with Shioko said about the TPP, all right? If I may make a remark, I would say the withdrawal from TPP is President Trump's biggest present send it to Beijing, all right? On the other hand, I'm very sympathetic with the Prime Minister Abe, Shinzo Abe. He put the Japan's law in the TPP as a part of his three arrow. Part of the three arrow, all right? The third one. And in order to accommodate the TPP, he make a lot of compromise by sacrifice or yield to U.S. pressure on the agriculture. Do you realize that LDP lose 5 out of the 6 seats, 5 out of 6 seats in the last upper house election in North agricultural area because of the TPP, in spite of the fact that LDP win the overall game, but still lose that. So the cost for Abe to join the TPP is very high. So I say I'm very sympathetic with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Thank you.
Rupert. Yes, sir. I tell you what, just to expedite it so we can get a few extra questions in, can you direct the question to perhaps a panelist or two, and then we can perhaps expedite the process?
Hello, Hongbin Ding from Loyola University, Maryland. I have two questions. The first question is for Mr. Scissors and Mr. Wong about Taiwan's economic strategy. I actually agree with both of you. I don't think Taiwan has an international economic strategy. If there's any strategy at a national level at all, it will be a domestic one instead of international one. However, for any strategy, there should be a vision for the strategy. So my question is, from all these discussions and the readings, I don't really see a clear vision of what Taiwanese government wanted to achieve if with their strategy or strategic moves, may it be developing Taiwan into a hub of global supply chain, like Peter suggested, or something else. So from your take, so what exactly is this economic vision for Taiwan's economic future? And my second question is for Ms. Goto. You mentioned that entrepreneurship is one of the great envies of Taiwan. And also, in today's panel, we also seen that basically we owe Lavender that, well, FDI is one of the things Taiwan has not been doing very well, actually doing very badly in the past. But we do know that entrepreneurs attract angels, entrepreneurs attract venture capitalists, and venture capital industry ecosystem, United States, that's basically pretty much the US. We are the most aggressive, most active investors to entrepreneurial talents. then how come these investment efforts, those type of specific FDIs, do not or fail to go to Taiwan to actually develop those talents and bring them over to the United States? Thank you.
I'm always going first. I don't, you know, as somebody who said I don't see an... Yeah, right. I'm louder. That's close to leader. in terms of international vision, there's clearly a desire, and we talked about it on the panel, and I've certainly talked about it with Taiwanese government officials, and then I think many people in the audience have had much more in the way of conversations than I have. There's an awareness of the need to diversify. It may be driven by politics, which I'm not talking about, but it should be driven by economics because the Chinese growth train is coming to a halt. So that's, I think that it's fair to say there's a vision of diversification. I think after that we have a lot of problems. I mean, they kind of look around and say, oh, look, these look like important economies, but there's no coherence. There's not enough detail. What exactly are you trying to accomplish? I'll stop at this point because I don't want to hark on this too much. What are you willing to sacrifice? The vision of going out, I think one of the panelists said they're losers as well. You don't get to say, I have a vision and everything will be great. And we will preserve all of our traditional industries and we will have new industries and we will still have a giant state sector and we will be competitive. That's not a vision, that's wish fulfillment. 3-year-olds have that kind of vision. So part of what I would really like to see in terms of a vision is Taiwan understanding that some things in Taiwan are going to lose. And there needs to be a movement into new sectors, new industries, new kinds of employment. That would be a crucial part of the vision that would help.
I think I'm just going to repeat what I said, I think, earlier. That is, I disagree with Derek on the fact that I think there is a strategy. And the strategy, you ask, is domestically to essentially bring Taiwan up the global value chain into a new set of innovative industries that ahead of perhaps, you know, a lot of the competitors like China now increasing, or Korea and so on. So that's a goal, and that's a strategy. And I agree with him on how hard it is to do for political and other reasons. But I think Taiwan should see this as a critical period to have to do it. It basically internationalize Taiwan's economy more than it has. It's still a little bit too protective in various different areas, whether it's private equity that Rupert talked about or other kinds of things, or state-owned enterprises and so on. So that is a strategy. The question is, can it be done, is another matter. And on New Southbound is a strategy in some ways because it's a major market. It's diversification. It's important economically and politically. So I think there is a strategy. I think it's going to be difficult. And one last point is, just to quickly on TPP, I don't want to go too far in criticizing TPP because I think it's a good thing. Because what it is, it's more than market opening. It's setting rules. And rules-based systems are important in the long term. Maybe not immediately, but in the long term. So we need to get back to it. But I think Taiwan does not have the luxury now to put too much resource into focusing on this in the short term, at least for its own interest.
Yeah, and just adding to the benefits of TPP, especially on IP, intellectual property rights, adhering to that would certainly be something that would strengthen Taiwan's position, and enhance the brand of Taiwan as well. And it would be a seal of confidence in the Taiwanese economy as well. About your question on entrepreneurship, it's not the lack of being able to grow homegrown talent. It's really being able to retain talent and repatriate talent. And that is something that there has been a disconnect. Bear in mind that 1/3 of Silicon Valley's startups are by foreigners, mostly Asian, many Taiwanese. What can be done to incentivize them to come back? I think there can be ways to make it more attractive, and there hasn't really been, when we talk about economic strategy, that should be part of that strategy as well.
The demographic issue on Taiwan is a national security issue. Taiwan has an acute problem with growing its population and no clear strategy yet for tackling that. One more question very quickly, ma'am. Yes, please. If you could be very quick, name, affiliation, and get right to your question.
Okay, Chia Ching from United Daily News. If you read the MCHAM white paper, many of the firms worry about Taiwan may face power shortage problem. So in order for Taiwan to be more attractive in terms of investment, should the government rethink its energy policy? Thank you.
Boy, we don't have a lot of time, which is good because that means I can't go on to this long rant. You can choose, you can decide that you're not going to generate energy from sources that you don't like, or you can decide to have lousy companies, but you really shouldn't do both. That would be my answer. So I would like a change of policy along those lines. Thank you.
Then why don't we all have a crack at that?
I think Taiwan is between a rock and a hard place on that policy because of the strong support against nuclear plants and so on. It's a hard choice. I will let them make it.
I'm not the biggest supporter of nuclear power, but when it comes to energy strategy, I do become a realist, and nuclear power does seem to be a viable option at this stage.
Quick, just very quick.
Peter.
I was in Taipei in June, set appointment long before I arrived Taipei. By the time I arrived Taipei, the MGM just released the white paper, all right? Mm-hmm. So the discussion, you know, focused on the laundry list of the American company. But in general, they support the US-Taiwan EPA, number one. Number two, they agree with me that Taiwan purchase more agricultural product overall, but U.S. not insist on sector-specific product, right? And for your information, there will be one agricultural procurement mission coming to the state. I think the end of this month or early next month to purchase more American agricultural commodity.
Thank you, yeah. Peter. You know, Power, I was in Taipei when the lights went out. It was quite something to sit in a hotel and look at some of the city in complete darkness. You know, from a commercial standpoint, the companies that the U.S. Taiwan Business Council works with are deeply concerned about the power situation. Mm-hmm. Reliable power is critical to many of these industries. Let's just take the chip industry for an example. You can't turn the power off, not if you want to incur significant costs. And the cost of continuing to invest in these sectors runs in the billions. So if they're thinking about, these companies are thinking about, where are we going to deploy new money? And they're thinking, right, what are the criteria? We need water. What are the environmental regulations? We need reliable power. What can they do with that third issue right now? Can they answer that question positively? I don't think so. Taiwan has a significant problem, and we've already discussed some of the challenges on investment. The power strategy has to be cleaned up, mm-hmm. and a clear path articulated to the citizens of the country and the businesses, both Taiwan businesses and international businesses there, about where the reliable, sustainable power is going to come from in the decades ahead. I really want to thank GTI, Russell, Chairman Lai, for this opportunity. I want you to join me in thanking our panelists this afternoon. Please stay in your seats. We have Acting Assistant Secretary for the Defense Department, Dave Helvey, coming to make some comments. He's already here, so if you would just remain in your seats, Dave is going to seamlessly move to the podium and then let us know what's on his mind.
Now it's my distinct honor to introduce our closing keynote, Dave Helvey. Dave Helvey is the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs. He is responsible for defense and security policy in the Asia and the Pacific region. Prior assignments in the Office of the Secretary of Defense include, most recently, Senior Advisor performing the duties of the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Affairs from June 2006 to January 2007. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for East Asia and with earlier assignment as Country Director for China, Director for China, Taiwan, and Mongolia. And his list of positions within senior government posts continues long, so I will not belabor all the assignments that he's had, only to say that we're very honored to have him here and look forward to his remarks. Unfortunately, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, for Defense, is unable to take questions afterwards, and so we'll close after his comments. Thank you very much. please join me in welcoming Dave.
Thank you very much, Russell. I really wanted to say I appreciate the opportunity to speak here today, and congratulations to you and to GTI for the conference that you're having today and for being here. I think it's important. Your institution plays an important role in building a public and collective understanding of Taiwan and of U.S.-Taiwan relations. And so I hope my remarks this afternoon will contribute to achieving that outcome. I was able to take a look at the agenda and some of the participants that were here today, and I am sincerely impressed by the wealth of expertise that participate in the conference. And I hope that the comments and insights that I'm going to offer this afternoon will contribute in some small way to the objectives that you set out for yourselves. The topic, upgrading U.S.-Taiwan relations for the 21st century, is as relevant in the defense arena as it is in any other, and I know you've talked about a bunch of them today. So what I'd like to do this afternoon is share with you some of my thoughts and perspectives on the values and principles that underpin the U.S.-Taiwan defense relationship, and also give you a sense of how we've worked with Taiwan over the past several years to improve its defense capabilities, and to outline some of our key areas of focus as we think about developing this relationship in the future. But first, I'd like to briefly address the importance of the U.S.-Taiwan relationship and describe the longstanding policy that the United States has held toward the island. The United States has an enduring interest in maintaining peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. We continue to encourage both sides of the Taiwan Strait to improve relations in a manner and at a pace that's acceptable to the people on both sides. We believe that a Taiwan that is secure, confident, and free from coercion is better able to engage Beijing constructively, which in turn supports a stable and peaceful cross-strait environment. The United States has been an Asia-Pacific power for more than a century, and we have a vested interest in the security of all of our partners and in the overall security of the region. You all know that the security of Taiwan is central to the security of the broader Asia-Pacific region. And Taiwan being an integral part of that region, the region is far better off when Taiwan is prosperous and secure. Taiwan is also a model for the region and for the world, with its market economy, its vibrant, prosperous, free, and orderly democratic society. The people on Taiwan have a great deal to be proud of, and shared values are they're a core element of the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. These values bind together the Department of Defense and the Taiwan Ministry of Defense in common cause. They also help to connect Taiwan with other free and democratic societies across the region and the world. Our policy towards Taiwan is founded on the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979, the three joint U.S.-China communiques, and is guided by the six assurances. This has remained unchanged across successive presidential administrations, and the United States government remains firmly committed to its one-China policy. The Taiwan Relations Act calls for the United States to provide Taiwan with arms of a defensive character and to maintain the capacity to resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize the security or social or economic system of the people of Taiwan. That last part was a quote, that's why I had to read it. The Department of Defense, working with the interagency, provides Taiwan with defensive weapons through the Foreign Military Sales Program and advises the State Department on direct commercial sales. Taiwan is the United States' largest foreign military sales partner in Asia and the second largest in the world. Since 2010, we've notified Congress of more than $15 billion in arms sales to Taiwan. And the capabilities that the Department of Defense has provided include some of our most advanced weapon systems, including the Apache attack helicopter, Patriot missile systems, and other advanced munitions. Taiwan's newest F-16 fighter, the F-16V or F-16 Viper, is a highly capable, modern aircraft. And between 2012 and 2016, the United States government licensed over $3 billion in arms sales and services to Taiwan through the direct commercial sale transactions. The most recent arms package to Taiwan was notified to our Congress in June of this year. It comprises more than $1 billion worth of equipment, including joint standoff weapons, high-speed anti-radiation missiles, Mark 48 heavyweight torpedoes, and upgrades of existing torpedoes to more advanced configurations, as well as other upgrades and technical support for other systems. But the United States' commitment to Taiwan does not begin and end with arms sales. The overall defense relationship is much broader and far more consequential. We're especially focused on assisting Taiwan with the non-hardware aspects of military capability. And this is one of the principal ways in which we've been upgrading our defense relationship. We've had a program in place to overhaul Taiwan's reserve forces and to make them more agile and effective in a 21st century combat environment. And this includes a focus on increasing the integration of active and reserve forces. And we're also working with Taiwan to develop improved joint doctrine, part of a larger effort to increase jointness and service interoperability across the Taiwan Armed Forces. In addition, we're upgrading our defense relationship by placing greater emphasis on asymmetric warfare. To provide one example, the United States Army has a new initiative to increase the agility of the Taiwan ground forces to enable them to operate in a more decentralized fashion with less reliance on higher level command and control. We're also assisting Taiwan with the development of an improved non-commissioned officer corps, and again, with an aim toward greater decentralization and with greater initiative at the NCO level. These and other efforts to train and assist the Taiwan military are central to our overall defense relationship. High-level talks with Taiwan are another key element of our comprehensive and durable partnership. These address a wide range of issues related to defense and foreign policy, and they help the Department of Defense to work with Taiwan's military. These talks directly impact arms sales, and they're also symbolically important in reflecting our broader commitment to the people on Taiwan. We have two senior-level defense dialogues with Taiwan that have occurred annually. One of them has been held every year for the past 22 years. The other for the past 16 years. We have additional ad hoc meetings that occur regularly, and we conduct robust service-level exchanges that focus on personnel, training, maintenance, tactics, professionalization, and any manner of topics that are of interest to professional militaries. All these efforts are indispensable to fulfilling the letter and spirit of the Taiwan Relations Act, and we'll continue to assess and reassess our efforts in order to make sure that they're updated to deal with the 21st century threats that's faced by the island. The principal challenge facing Taiwan, of course, is the long-term comprehensive military modernization that's being undertaken by Beijing. As the Department stated in its most recent report to Congress on this subject, Taiwan continues to be the PLA's main strategic direction and focus for its modernization. While the People's Republic of China considers other areas to have high strategic importance, including the East China Sea and the South China Sea, its borders with India and North Korea, Taiwan remains the principal driver of the PLA's force modernization and its expansion. The PLA continues to develop and to deploy a variety of capabilities that threaten Taiwan, with a significant number of these deployed to the military areas opposite Taiwan across the Taiwan Strait. And of particular concern in this regard are ground-launched ballistic and cruise missiles. And these continue to advance both in number and in capability. China is also investing in one of the most lethal integrated air defense systems in the world. This includes large numbers of fighter aircraft as well as surface-to-air missile systems with increasing range and sophistication. The PLA Air Force now has about 600 fourth-generation fighter aircraft and will likely become a majority fourth-generation Air Force within the next several years. And as many of you know here, they're also developing fifth-generation fighter aircraft. The PLA Navy is an increasingly advanced and flexible force that's comprised of over 300 surface ships and submarines. It's rapidly retiring its older surface combatants and replacing these with larger multi-mission ships equipped with advanced anti-air, anti-ship, and anti-submarine weapons and sensors. Most recently, the PLA Air Force has conducted long-range overwater bomber missions in the Western Pacific, and these are bracketing Taiwan. And it's not just the weapon systems when you think about the PLA. The PLA is stepping up its training, and in recent years it's conducted a number of large-scale joint exercises such as STRIDE and Mission Action. And what's notable, these are explicitly focused on Taiwan scenarios, and they're being openly discussed in Chinese media. The PLA continues to focus its training on large-scale and complex joint operations with greater realism and sophistication. The bottom line on that is they're getting better, and they're getting better quickly. China's developing the capacity to coerce Taiwan, and if directed, to compel unification by force. There are no indications now that Beijing is preparing to renounce the use of force, either now or in the future. It's therefore incumbent upon Taiwan to invest in the capabilities to deter aggression and to mount an effective defense should deterrence fail. The United States strongly supports Taiwan in these efforts. The challenge for Taiwan is not that it must be able to defeat the People's Liberation Army, but rather it must develop and sustain a credible means to deny the PLA victory. This is our key measure of success, and it's essential for deterrence. Taiwan has made considerable strides in developing effective deterrent and defense forces, but it can and must do more as the PLA threat continues to evolve. To capitalize on the success of recent years, there are four main areas that we believe Taiwan should focus on in terms of its defense transformation. The first is prioritizing its defense resourcing. The second is prioritizing homeland defense. The third is developing a capable and effective force. And the last is investing in asymmetric capabilities. In terms of the first, Taiwan should increase its defense spending. It hasn't kept pace with the threat. There's a temptation to focus on the percentage of GDP that's devoted to defense, and that's not all that bad. But what's more important and what really matters is that Taiwan has the resources that it needs to develop a military that's effective against the People's Liberation Army, to take advantage of key defensive and geographic advantages that only Taiwan has. This doesn't require a massive investment, but Taiwan needs greater resources to modernize its equipment, to train realistically, to recruit highly skilled personnel, and to develop advanced indigenous weapon systems. There's no substitute for providing the resources needed to achieve these goals. Simply increasing the top line will not be sufficient, though. The resources have to be focused on the right capabilities. The second main area in which Taiwan should increase its emphasis is on homeland defense. Taiwan should focus its efforts on acquiring capabilities that can defeat the People's Liberation Army's power projection forces at locations near Taiwan's main island, where its defensive advantages are greatest. This is the one phase of the battle that Taiwan cannot afford to lose. Taiwan must invest in military capabilities that are best suited to this purpose, and it must have the personnel and the doctrine, the training and the tactics to induce uncertainty in an aggressor, about his ability to prevail in a contest close to Taiwan's shores. The PLA needs to wake up every morning and say, today is not the day. We've seen significant progress in this regard. The Taiwan Navy is developing new systems and capabilities that target the center of gravity of an invasion force, with tailored capabilities to take advantage of shoreline defenses where lines of communication are shortest and the vulnerabilities for an invading force are most acute. Taiwan's investments in sea mines, coastal defense artillery, land and sea-based mobile anti-ship cruise missiles, UAVs, fast attack patrol boats, hardening decoys, camouflage, long list of issues here. But these investments considerably bolster Taiwan's ability to defend the homeland and to slow an invading force when it approaches Taiwan's shores. Sorry, I was up on the hill earlier today. I've been talking more than usual. Third, Taiwan must emphasize the development of an effective, capable force. This is not just about having the capacity to deny, disrupt, or defeat the PLA's air and maritime operations. It's about having the capacity to withstand air, missile, and cyber attacks while being able to pose a credible and persistent threat to any invading PLA force. This requires an examination of the human capital aspects, including the right mix of volunteers and conscripts and the right balance between the active and reserve forces, and rethinking the role of reserves and the relationship between the reserve forces and the broader Taiwan society. Fourth, and most importantly, Taiwan needs to increase development of asymmetric capabilities to counter PLA aggression. There's an appreciation on both sides that traditional approaches to the defense of Taiwan are no longer viable in light of the growing capabilities of the PLA. Taiwan must transform its defense to include more asymmetric and innovative approaches. In our view, this should include a greater emphasis on large numbers of small things: mobile, networked, and highly lethal weapon systems aided by military deception. Key examples include mobile coastal defense cruise missiles and mobile surface-to-air missile systems. Taiwan's already made considerable progress in shifting its defense planning and procurement efforts towards non-traditional, innovative, and asymmetric approaches. And Taiwan deserves a great deal of credit for this transformation. But the size, scope, and pace of the challenge that it faces causes us to focus our attention on what remains to be done rather than what's been successfully accomplished. I can't emphasize enough the importance of Taiwan's continued progress in this area. Transitioning towards greater asymmetry, innovation, and adaptation is absolutely essential to Taiwan's future. We must bear in mind that Taiwan's demonstrated commitment to its own defense is a critical factor in maintaining deterrence and preserving a stable and peaceful cross-strait environment. The Taiwan military commitment to asymmetry, innovation, and adaptation is part of this important deterrence equation. Now, we recognize the complex that this is a complex mission, and it's becoming even more complex over time as the threat from the PLA evolves. But this shouldn't deter Taiwan from continuing to examine itself and to improve its self-defense capabilities. Taiwan has significant defensive advantages, which, if they're properly exploited by asymmetric and innovative and adaptive forces, can pose major operational challenges to an aggressor. As the PLA threat continues to grow in size and complexity, Taiwan must think more flexibly and creatively about how to exploit its inherent defensive advantages. Consistent with the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States government remains steadfastly committed to supporting Taiwan in these efforts, including by making available to it defense articles and services that are necessary to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability. But Taiwan has also made a great deal of progress developing on its own, developing new indigenously produced defense systems that are more mobile, that are more survivable, and able to take advantage of Taiwan's geography. In some cases, Taiwan may build for itself asymmetric capabilities because the United States doesn't make them. Some of these capabilities that Taiwan may develop are highly effective at exploiting an opponent's weaknesses and targeting its center of gravity. Taiwan's mobile coastal defense cruise missile systems are one highly capable example. Taiwan's new emphasis on producing defense systems indigenously is a consequential step in this regard. The Department of Defense recognizes and appreciates Taiwan's aspirations to be increasingly self-reliant for its own defense, as well as its desire to increase the benefits of defense spending for its own economy and for the broader Taiwan society. Taiwan has a long and successful history of cooperative indigenous defense programs, including through the licensed production of Perry-class frigates and the indigenous defense fighter. Both of these prove that the concept itself is viable. In addition, Taiwan's defense industry has demonstrated that it's highly capable at producing asymmetric, affordable, and survivable weapon systems. Key examples include small, fast attack boats, mobile ground-launched anti-ship cruise missiles, and multiple launch rocket systems. At the same time, we need to be clear that Taiwan's efforts to prioritize indigenous capabilities will present new challenges. The United States government fully supports Taiwan's efforts to improve its self-defense capabilities through any legitimate means. However, the United States government does not own much of the technology that Taiwan seeks for its domestic industry. This will necessitate closer cooperation between Taiwan and U.S. defense contractors and require them to establish new relationships. It also raises new issues related to protecting sensitive United States technology. Taiwan will need to ensure compliance with United States standards and requirements for safeguarding sensitive defense technology. This will be a new and challenging experience for some partners that have been involved in direct commercial sales. And I would encourage Taiwan to focus on improving its processes and procedures in this area so that we can enhance cooperation. Likewise, Taiwan may also need to establish new regulatory mechanisms in order to expand its partnerships here. It must reassure the United States government that sensitive technology will be protected against inappropriate transfer. To fulfill its goals, Taiwan will need to address some unique and challenging problems. For instance, to what extent will companies with significant business interests on the mainland participate in Taiwan's indigenous defense programs? Given the relatively small size of Taiwan's military and defense budget, will the production of small numbers of weapon systems indigenously be cost-effective or attractive for U.S. suppliers? Traditionally, the Department of Defense and its contractors absorb a great deal of the cost and risk associated involved in developing and producing new weapon systems, including from delays, cost overruns, and quality assurance or performance problems. By the time these systems are sold to foreign countries, many of the bugs have been worked out and the risks have been greatly reduced for our customers. As Taiwan transitions towards indigenous manufacturing, aided by direct commercial sales, the risks of developing new weapon systems will be shifted to the buyers, and that's something that Taiwan will need to reconcile. Addressing these and many other issues will be important to the success of any indigenous defense production initiative. Taiwan's shift towards increasing self-reliance does not mean that the Department of Defense, however, will lessen its commitment to Taiwan. The Department will be there to help Taiwan think through these issues and will continue to work closely with the Ministry of National Defense in supporting Taiwan's efforts to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability. Finally, I want to reiterate that the United States views a strong, secure, prosperous, and confident Taiwan as being fundamentally in our interests. And we're committed to supporting Taiwan's efforts to develop the defensive capabilities to resist coercion and to deter aggression. We face many challenges in the region, and ensuring peace and security in the Taiwan Strait is a vitally important one to us. Taiwan's commitment to preserving freedom, prosperity, and peaceful and stable cross-strait relations stands as an example for others to follow in the Asia-Pacific region. And I'm convinced that in the coming years, we will continue to build on these values and the successes that we've already shared. So I want to thank you for your time this afternoon, and thank you for hearing me out. And I certainly wish you great success in the rest of this conference. So, thanks.
And thank you, Dave, for spending time with us, and really for those sobering as well as encouraging remarks. And that brings our inaugural symposium to a close. Finally, I'd like to just take this opportunity again to thank our co-founders, our board of directors, our counselors, advisors, all of you, and most importantly, also the staff here at the Global Taiwan Institute, Melissa, Anna, Dave, Lily, Jonathan, as well as our legion of volunteers who've volunteered, gave their time here to help staff this meeting. And please join me in giving them a round of applause. All right, that closes the inaugural symposium. Thank you.